If there's content that's borderline, that's content that we basically will not.
There is no second best. There is no second best crypto asset.
I respect you, and I have a great deal of appreciation to you, Jaya.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG Tonight. How are you doing? We'll have a chill show tonight. Chill show. People have already sent their question. FixDSM was asking, what's your thoughts on BTC and crypto thinking of re-entering? Yeah, it wouldn't be crazy to re-enter right now. It's hard to tell whether there will be another low or whether it will go high. If you want to be greedy about it, you can wait for the next down. But I cannot guarantee that there will be a next down. So it could very well be the entry to the next bull run. And things will get harder and harder to predict. So you don't want to be too greedy about it. I can't really tell you. I'd say there's 50% chance that we're going back to 62K or maybe even lower. And then there's a 50% chance that the bottom has already been attained. And I'm pretty neutral about it. So do as you please according to your level of risk. But generally, being out of Bitcoin is a bad idea for too long. Bitcoin always surprises you. So it's almost better to get back right now and accept that maybe you're going to be disappointed and it's going to go down to 40K, 50K. But it's kind of dreamish also to think that it would go that low and that the institutions wouldn't be back to buy it. There's also the looming threat of, you know, at some point, Trump will get his point across that he wants the Fed to expand the economy. And whether that Trump succeeds at doing this or the elections come and somehow there's lots of pressure to expand the economy and to get to money printing, to lower the interest rates. And at some point, this is going to work. And even if it's war that eventually causes a kind of local economic depression, and then the politicians respond by printing money. Something's got to give. So it's very unwise to stay out of Bitcoin too much, too long in this context. We have Anon has been asking the deep questions. He says, Jeff, is the fact that there's no objective truth related to the incompleteness theorems? If I have a consistent epistemological system good enough to prove arithmetic, then there's a fact the system can't prove.
I've been getting recommended vids like five things ought to.
We'll get back to your super chat. I'm going to finish the statement. Anon says, if I have a consistent epistemological system good enough to prove basic arithmetic, then there's a fact this system can't prove or disprove. Yeah, so you're referring to the Gödel theorems. The Gödel theorems state that basically a system of thought of any kind is going to generate internal truths. Even if you were to start with the ponies are purple. Okay, so this generates a system of truth. All of the ponies are purple. It's an axiom. And just like the axioms of arithmetic or geometry, it expands into a circle of self-consistent truths. So for example, if you just start with the Euclidean axioms, you get the idea that triangles The sum of the angles of a triangle is always 180 degrees. All right. So axioms lead to truths. Now, the truths of the Euclidean axioms are provable. So you can prove that just defining lines, circles, points, parallels, just defining those Euclidean postulates gets you to be able to prove that triangles have 180 degrees total. Now, the Gödel theorems are theorems that came much later in philosophy and mathematics, which have shown that there must be something, there must be a statement in your system that is true, but that you can't prove. So in the way you succeeded at proving that triangles have 180 degrees, we can say for sure, thanks to the Gödel theorems, that there is also something in your system that you won't ever be able to prove, and yet that is true. And Gödel has proven this using a sort of inverted sentence, a sort of construction of that truth. So he has the toy model version of this theorem is if you had a set of cards and they make statements about the truth, and you have a card in there that says the statement on the other side of the card is false. And then you have on the other side of the card a statement that says the statement on the other side of the card is false. So you have here embedded self-referring statements. That is the key to the Gödel theorems. Embedded self-referring truths. They are true but unattainable by proof. They are kind of shelled from the reach of proofs from the axioms you started with. And this reveals the simple fact that you can invoke this kind of contradictory embedded statement in any system, as shown by Gödel, proves that any system is incomplete. So there are facts about geometry that you'll never be able to prove. Now, these facts can be very uninteresting, and so you don't have to go depressed because of the Gödel theorems. There's no reason to go depressed and to think, there's all these truths that are never going to be achievable by proofs. It's possible that the Gödel theorems are completely unimportant, because it's possible that those unreachable truths of the system are trivial and unimportant. It's possible that basically anything you could care about in geometry will be provable. And that's more where I lay. I don't lay on the depressive side of the Gödel theorems. I lay more in the conviction that anything that is beautifully stated must have a beautiful proof to it, and that the Gödel theorem are far down the line of our worries, and they refer to very, very specific statements that are typically not what you're looking for. Now, your statement, Jeff, is the fact that there's no objective truth related to the incompleteness theorems. Well, that statement assumes that there is no objective truth. And depends on how you define objective exactly, but there is something like objective truth, certainly. There is something in the universe, certainly there is common agreement possible on things outside of the subject, and therefore there are points of the universe we can agree on. Now, it turns out that perhaps given the laws of physics, not everything is objectively true. If the Uluru radiation is real, then there are certain particles that an observer could see and that another observer would disagree don't exist. But in general, there is something like objective truth. You know, the table is there for me and it's there for you, and it's an object and it's outside of us, so it's objective. So I wouldn't say there's no objective truth because of the incompleteness theorem. And then your second question is, if I have a consistent epistemological system good enough to prove basic arithmetic, then there's a fact this system can't prove or disprove. That is the Gödel statement. So that would be correct. But as Kay is still here, I'd pointed out in the chat in response to you, that doesn't involve or imply or even relate to objective truths. The Gödel theorems are about statements and self-reference. And because knowledge is self-reference, this is what Lucas Gage doesn't understand. Lucas Gage thinks he has proven that he has abolished an old problem of philosophy of epistemology. I don't remember exactly the statement of the theorem, but it's the idea that basically any truth is either assumed, derives from something you've assumed, or circular. And the problem is to think that you can solve this problem is to misunderstand knowledge. Knowledge is circular by definition. Knowledge is circular because knowledge is coherence. And from the theoretical domain of mathematics to empiricism, it's always about coherence. And coherence implies circularity. So if you were to say, I have the Euclidean axioms, I have proven, yeah, it's the Agrippa trilemma, that is the name, yes, Jackie Chan. So if you are to say, I have the Euclidean axioms, I have derived the idea that triangles have a total sum of angles of 180 degrees, you could also go the other way. You could start with the idea that the triangles must have 180 degrees, and you could prove back some of the Euclidean axioms. So because of the arbitrary position of axioms as an entry into an epistemological system of any kind, even if you start with the axiom, I am a scientist, I see things, therefore these things are true, and I have a theory about the world. Even empiricism respects this. It is down the line circular. It is always circular. And so you won't solve the Agrippa trilemma, Lucas Gage. I love Lucas, and I love that he's enthusiastic about all this. But you won't solve the Agrippa trilemma because you would have defined knowledge away. Knowledge is consistency, coherence between what you arbitrarily decide is an axiom and what you arbitrarily position as a finding in your system. All of it must be ultimately coherent, and therefore there must be a function that links axioms to propositions and propositions to axioms. The one-way function from axioms to conclusions is reversible. And therefore, there must be a way around. And therefore, there must be a circle. I wish Lucas Gage understood this. If someone can send him this timestamp. Lucas, knowledge has to be circular. Circularity is not a problem. It is a necessity of knowledge. Because coherence necessitates two-way functions, one that goes to that point and one that comes back. And there is a two-way function linking even the Euclidean axioms to its propositions. Anyways, why are we doing such advanced stuff on this Ask Me Anything? All right, let's get to this super chat.
I've been getting recommended vids like 5 things autistic people do lately. For example, it takes extra time to transition from one activity to another. Or like, getting into the shower, staying wet, then getting out as 2 transitions. What do you think?
I'm annoyed by these videos. I've been seeing them being shared on the Discord. Maybe that's where you got them. Like, people have been sharing on the Discord these videos about get to know autism. And I hate this. I hate these videos because they frame autism as a disorder, and it's kind of annoying because in my view it's like get to know the normies. Can you imagine if I made a video about normies? And like, it's incredible, the dysfunctional lives of the normie. But no one will ever do that video, see? That's the problem. No one will ever make a video saying, let me introduce you to 5 things that the non-autists do. Can you believe this? They spend 30 fucking minutes when they encounter someone they know on the streets, and they lose that part of the day forever by exchanging meaningless statements. Oh, how have you been doing? Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Like, let's make a video about this. Because the reason I may have a little hang up when I get out of the shower might be because I'm thinking more clearly than you. Okay? The reason I take maybe a second to say, wait a minute, I've just been dipped in water. I wonder about other civilization and whether they have the equivalent of a shower. And then I draw the line of infinite interstellar space in my mind, and I'm like, how many of these civilizations have showers? How many of these showers are in water? How many bathe in methane instead? So yeah, maybe it takes me a minute to get to the towel. But I'm dripping water first. I'm hurting no one. And I'm reflecting about the fucking universe. So why don't you shut the fuck up with your cute little special video about what's special about autism? Because what's the weirdest to me is that people will lose much more than that minute spending time saying absolutely stupid crap. Fucking normies. Now, thanks for your super chat. I appreciate, but I'm not excited at all about these videos that denormalize autism. I am absolutely certain that autism was the default state of the male for hundreds of thousands of years. I don't know what took over this civilization. I don't know what took over our genetic direction to go somewhere else, but I am absolutely certain in my mind, I am the original man. Everything is adrift away from me. I feel in my home. I was at the right place on planet Earth 100,000 years ago. I'm still the same guy. Because I feel that need to be hanging meat on ropes, letting it dry, eating meat from bones. I know that I'm the original caveman. Stop denormalizing me. Start asking yourself, where did things go wrong? Where did the normie emerge? ELDR says, the most autistic thing about me is that I hate fake signals more than anything else. It's the most interesting waste of time thing there ever was. Uninteresting waste of time thing there ever was. I await the great filter. You're just waiting for the great filter. Yeah, very interesting. I mean, so yeah, the framing of modern civilization, I hate it. This is a whole feminine framing, by the way. The idea, I have an autistic child. Fuck you. Floodland says, question, in your opinion, what are the chances that Israel uses the Samson option if they are losing the war against Iran? I'm not super worried about this option. I don't think it's rational, but at the same time, should we count on rationality? Should we count on rationality here, or should we just say everything is possible? Maybe everything is possible. I don't know. But it's not something that's on my mind. I don't worry about this very much. Sadi Edward says, German engineering and Swiss watches is autism in its purest form. Exactly. Marty Party says, hello, Jeff. Do you still take call-ins for the AMAs on the Discord? Absolutely. We can do a call-in if you'd like. Let's see. All right. Hello, can we hear you, Samurai?
Hello, testing. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. What's up?
Hey, how are you doing, Mr. JFG?
I'm doing great.
Glad to hear it. Listen, it's been a long time. I used to come on the AMA. I think I came on once or twice, but it was something like 3 years ago, 4 years ago. So it's good to hear you. I only have a little bit of time to chat. I just saw you were live on YouTube. But I was thinking, because the last time I talked to you, I feel like afterwards I went on this sort of, I went on a bit on this binge of some of the streams during the Worski Live days, you know, okay. Hearing some of these people about like Alt Hype, you know, Sean Last, all of these guys. And I was obsessed with this idea of, obsession is a bit of a strong word, but I was fascinated by this idea of sort of the human biodiversity stuff, the differences in intelligence. And, you know, I go and look at the timestamps. It's like 2017, 2018. I'm way late to the game. I was way late to the game on some of this stuff. Do you think this is something that's still not, like, the HBD, the race realism stuff is something that's still very much not in the mainstream, but it had its day in some sense, right? But you still get people like that woman with the guy, I can't remember any of these people's names, but you know that interview with the woman and the guy with the big dorky glasses, and she's saying,
yeah,
there's no scientific evidence that, you know, for example, a black woman is genetically different than a white man.
Yeah. So race denial.
Race denial. I think that's still the default. I think that's still the default in a lot of places. But you know, in sort of these autistic online circles, it had its day. It had its day, I suppose. And, you know, I felt like I was getting late to the party. Nobody knows where some of these, like, who knows where the alternative hypothesis is for now, or, you know, JFG isn't on YouTube trending, which is totally fine. Hey, listen, I wanted to ask you about something, though. Just wanted to chat about this concept. There's this isn't super, super new, but it's kind of become more of a popular talking point in sort of these anti-immigration, and I think specifically like far right sort of American first circles, is with some of the Indian, stuff. You know, I think that's become kind of a bit of a popular punching bag, a bit of a popular target. I was wondering if I could get your perspective on where that comes from exactly.
All right. Yeah, I can comment on this. I'll say bye-bye to you. because you're asking about edgy subjects, but I will give an answer. I just don't want to hear from you much more. Yeah, the race consciousness has been achieving a peak in terms of penetration of mainstream culture. I think it's to be celebrated. Personally, I've never been an extremist of obsessed with race. No matter how much the left, has been trying to paint me as this, the fact is that first and foremost, I got into even talking about race because I perceived there was a deficit of truth in public communication. And the fact is, despite what you'll see on my Wikipedia bio and what you'll read about me in the newspaper, the fact is I don't care all that much about race, but I care that much about truth. And to me, the big lie is first the denial of genetics and race existing. So we led that fight and we won, basically. It is to be celebrated that we reached that peak to the point where there was a public engagement, and now it is not so taboo. And now with Elon Musk's X, we can talk about it totally freely. And now there is not an opposition anymore. You know, you'll have uninformed normie like these people. We've seen the guy with the thick glasses and his wife. These people will continue their denial. But there is not a standing... it wasn't the guy with the glasses, I think, that was making this denial, but it was the journalist in front of him. So, but the guy wasn't particularly good at defending the pro-race view. There will continue to be a stream of normie denial, and that's not important, really, because we won the debate to the extent that there was someone willing to show up. The last leftists who were willing to show up at this debate, they got totally owned outside of the internet to the point of shame, like Kraut and Tea, leaving the internet for months. So it's like, really, we stepped over them and we won. And there is not a serious person out there, even in the left and the denial part of this. So look at, for example, the Brett Weinstein of this world. They know how to shut up about this. Why do you think Brett Weinstein never says anything important about race? It's because he knows it's true. And so we have confined the dishonest to just shutting up about it. We have confined the person who doesn't want to engage with the truth to be forced to display his unwillingness of engagement on this. They're no more claiming these crazy things like Kraut and Tea were claiming. If they are leftists, what they do is they just don't talk about it. And they just say, maybe there is a time at which we can talk about race, but that's not the right time right now. So you see how interesting that is? We have shut up the lies. And we have confined them to a lie by omission. Now, that's a victory to be celebrated. Of course, the liars will keep lying. But the last tool that they have that's available is the lie by omission. It's the non-willingness to engage on this. It's the, oh, I'm not going to engage with JF because I don't like this or that about him. Now, that's a more feminine, personal thing. They no more have a philosophical claim that what we say about race is true, is false. So they can't fight the fact that it's true. Now, you have pointed out about Indians. So it's a natural pivot that we are now highlighting in, you now see people highlighting on the X feed, the reality that, yes, you know, what we've discussed about the differences between races does not just apply to black versus white. And let's not forget that we have a lot of academic data that comes from a time at which institutions were free to pursue those facts. But at that time, there weren't much Indians in America. And so we actually have a lack of supply of data about the extent to which the way we know there are genetic differences between blacks and whites, we know a little less. It's not that we don't know, actually. We know that the same principles apply to any group. But we know a little less simply from the fact that we have less of an accumulation of comparison between Indians and whites. And so we have less of an insight, first. Secondly, the history of the entry of Indians within America is different than how blacks came to America. So blacks have a history related to slavery. Indians were selected by immigration, very often professional or marriage-related immigration. This had an accidental selective effect. I mean, accidental, not so accidental, but it had a selective effect on IQ and on capacity to perform in the workplace. So if you start paying attention to just, well, do they have the same IQ as whites or even higher? Or, oh, let's look at their annual salary. You're going to find yourself realizing that a lot of the criteria you were using to distinguish between black and white population traditionally do not apply here. And that is why I like to think that I'm kind of a visionary, because for many years I've told people, don't obsess too much about IQ. Don't obsess too much about IQ, because you're going to end up in the trap of thinking that, oh, well, as long as they are 100 IQ, we can accept infinite immigration, right? They're making good annual salaries, right? And that would be an error. Because here's the thing, no matter how, even if they were to beat you in IQ, even if you look at Asian populations, they have 2 or 3 IQ points above us. That doesn't mean you should want your genetic destiny to be flooded by infinite dilution. We should be able to decide as a country that it's not a technocratic question whether we are interested in welcoming migrants, that it's not about whether they have an annual salary. Because this is the argument that you see rising right now. Oh, well, the Indians have a good annual salary, even higher than whites. Well, let's think about the reasons for this. First, you've totally disadvantaged whites on the workplace. So you made a biased game. You created programs that allow Indians to start literally to start grocery stores and convenience stores on loans that are forgivable at times. You've given them advantages that you don't give to whites. Secondly, you selected them. So it's not like it's going to be the average talent of their children. You selected them in a pool of immigration entry, so they are not representative of their final genetic convergence. You have cherry-picked Indians to enter America, And that doesn't necessarily hold across generations. It's not because you've picked some of the most intelligent Indians to enter America that their children will be as intelligent. Because there's such a thing as reversal to the mean. And there's such a thing as an effect of the average Indian gene versus the special case that you selected. Thirdly, you've basically abolished racial fairness in the workplace. And you have created a situation in big tech, for example, where the big tech isn't even interested at white people applications. They just want their H-1B slaves because that's controllable. You know, an H-1B slave is basically someone who's totally dependent on you, someone who his whole life is based around working at your place. You pay him an apartment, and he's basically a contained box. He's a contained pod containing a human that you fully control. So don't come and tell me, oh, well, the Indians are scoring well on annual income reports. Well, no shit. With these advantages. But in any case, it shouldn't be about IQ and it shouldn't be about annual salary. The question of genetic existence should be at the heart of our concern when we think immigration. The exact way to approach the problem is the way with which you would approach should we take the whales from Japan and seed them into the seas of Europe to compete with the local whales. And it's like, no. Yeah, so that's what I had to say about the immigration issue. Immigration is about existence, and it's not about GDP. There's no reason to sacrifice your genetic legacy for GDP. Just like there's no reason to replace the European whales with the Japanese whales. There's no reason why you would do that. You invasive subpopulations, why would you bring them? Why would you mess up an ecological system that's stable? For what? Maintaining GDP? It's much more important to maintain your genes than maintaining GDP. GDP is an artifice, by the way. It really doesn't matter. So Poopy Stinky says, asks for my thoughts about the Shroud of Turin. I have seen the whole Tucker Carlson episode about this many months ago. I have reviewed the arguments and reflected about them. I think it's interesting, the case that is being made. So it's the idea that this linen, this piece of linen, would be the genuine linen in which the body of Jesus Christ was wrapped. And the belief is that the thing is, it was cared for so much across the centuries as it was kept by a line of sometimes kings and travelers and rich families. It would have been cared so much and handled by sisterhood, some maybe woman of the church repairing it, and sometimes some scratches appeared on it, and it would have been replaced by fresher tissues, such that today we are misled to believe that it's a fraud. And some scientists, you know, have tested the corner of it, and they found, oh, well, this doesn't come from Israel. But the argument being made by the proponent of this theory is that the Shroud of Turin actually is the real Shroud of Turin, that the scientific tests were made improperly, that the scientists caught a little corner of it, but it happens to be a corner that was repaired by a nun later, like centuries down the line. And that if you make the actual test on the parts that weren't repaired, that you can find the trace of genetic signs of pollen plants that has been preserved into the shroud that shows its path of travel, perhaps from the Middle East, from a place like Jerusalem up to Eastern Europe and eventually to Western Europe. And the belief is that the stains, if you will, that we see on this indicate they have parallels that are traceable into the Bible, describing the exact way in which Jesus would have been killed and the exact injury positions. And a further claim made by the same man is that a flash carbon-like copy appears at the level of the head, and that this would be a physical flash that was caused by a burst of energy that happened at the moment of the resurrection of Jesus that would have imprinted a kind of photocopy-like, a quantum flash of physical energy that was induced by a level of energy that he describes as impossible to reach physically other than through some miracle. Listen, Ty Rogerson says there's a lot going on with that shroud. Listen, it's a slide and you fall down. I find it interesting, the first claims. I find that these claims would probably even be more credible if they weren't accompanied by the resurrection claim. Like, it's very interesting, the possibility, because I do believe that Jesus was some kind of historical character that actually existed. So I do believe that there's a guy who has been very annoying, and that eventually his community asked of the Romans to kill him. And the Romans did it. Or allowed it, if you will. Did it. So I do believe that this has happened. Simply because there are enough historical references. And you can see that the Bible in itself stands as a historical reference, even before it's a propaganda outlet, even before it got written by the Romans, you can think that there's enough historical reference points that this wasn't written as a pure hallucination. So you can tell that this was recorded as some sort of historical fact that someone may not have known exactly, and therefore could contain all sorts of imprecisions, but that someone was trying to record at least what was said about this sequence of events, especially in the Romans part. So the first thing is, I believe that the Bible is at least an attempt, if not a relatively successful historical report. And so it is very interesting to consider the possibility that a surviving shroud coming randomly from the Middle East, but having been cared by a chain of humans who cared enough about it, could be the exact shroud that this guy who got killed in the Middle East by the Romans has been wrapped in. I mean, when you think about it, the shroud, if you just believe, for example, the pollen examination, which I don't know, I can't verify, but suppose that the claim about the pollen is true, then this shroud comes from the Middle East. And this shroud is some sort of wrap in which some person was wrapped, and the length of it gives a very plausible story that it was a body that was wrapped, and the traces of the shape of the body on it and the head make it a very likely hypothesis that it was a human body wrapped in this. And therefore, there is, at least if you recognize both the historicity, or at least the attempt of historicity of the Bible, and you recognize those basic facts, chemical, biological analysis of the shroud, if you accept these two things, then you must accept that there's at least a probability that it's the shroud that was wrapping Jesus. Now, you can go naive probability and you can say, oh, well, there were so many people crucified then that it's very unlikely that it's the shroud of Turin, the shroud that wrapped Jesus. And on this, then you have two paths. You can either say, all right, well, it was a small probability, but the shroud was carried and identified by people who cared enough about it. And so it wasn't some random criminal that got wrapped in this. It was a series of people who claimed this, by the way, this is the shroud that Jesus was wrapped in. And so already you have here a funneling of your probabilistic claim. So now you're down to, well, were these people lying? So you were starting at, well, it's one of the shrouds. So it's 1 out of 100,000 chance that it was the shroud of Jesus. But now you're into, well, it's a shroud that has been claimed by that chain of people to somehow be the shroud of Jesus. And so you have to weigh that credibility. Now, what's the credibility of a chain of people in history? Some of them potentially including thieves, liars, deluded women, and kings, and philosophers, and somehow ends up in some French guy's... I don't know the whole history, but, you know, an eclectic chain of beings over 2,000 years. What's the credibility of that? And the answer is anywhere between 50% true and 0.0001% true, depending on the various circumstances along the way. So that's one path you can take. You can take the path of, well, how would it have been held and believed for apparently centuries to be the shroud of Jesus if it wasn't the shroud of Jesus, given that it has the pollen indicative of the origin and given that we acknowledge the rough historicity of the Bible. And you can take also the other route, which is perhaps a more tentative route, but that is the route that is being proposed by the guy who appeared on Tucker Carlson. So there are enough elements in the Bible that allow to trace a correlation between what you see on the shroud and the Bible. So when the Bible describes the lengthy suffering of Jesus, you can locate certain facts. You have the thorn, the idea of a thorn. You have the idea of some injuries in specific areas. You have the planting of a spear into what the flank of Jesus. Now you can trace these correlations and see, well, the Shroud of Turin seems to contain a trace of each of these events. So something that seems to indicate some kind of a thorn, something that seems to indicate a flank piercing or the kind of accumulation of of blood or water in the flank that eventually gets pierced and soils the shroud. So now you have another set of probabilistic fact with which you can jungle and say, well, to what extent would that happen to an average crucified person? To what extent would a bunch of humans who want to fake the Shroud of Turin, would they go through the trouble of reading the whole Bible and reproducing exactly those features that are expected in the Bible? Because let's not forget, if you go into any church, you'll see some sorts of symbolisms. Like you go to a Catholic church, you look on the wall, you're going to see the path of the cross of Jesus. Now, those are paintings, and they're definitely painted after the fact. They are modern paintings meant to represent what happened to Jesus. Now, if someone was in 100,000 years picking up those portraits, they might believe that, hey, I'm dating those portraits, and they are pretty much around the time where Jesus is claimed to have lived. So maybe those were actual records of the life of Jesus. Maybe there was a guy painting actual path of cross of Jesus. But he would be wrong. The paintings would have come after to reproduce and to represent what happened to Jesus. Now, I can't exclude that the Shroud of Turin is like the portraits that you see in Catholic churches right now. That the Shroud of Turin may have been a creation of maybe a 4th century Christian or a 6th century Christian who wanted to make a display for Christmas or something like this. Who wanted to make a display of maybe a museum-type attraction that reproduces the resurrection of Jesus and reproduces perhaps some of the scenes of Jesus. And it's like, if someone was to do this, it would have exactly the features of that shroud. Perhaps he even reproduced a whole fake body of Jesus for museum purposes. Perhaps there was a whole church in which they were reproducing the whole scene of Jesus. After all, they do this every Christmas. They already do this. You already have little Jesus figurines with the mage, the I don't know what's the term in English, but the mages. That's how we call them in French. So the three mages and the little goat and the little creche. With Mary giving birth to Jesus. So if we are making these little Christmas displays of the magi, so if we are making these Christmas displays, it's not out of the question that someone in Eastern Europe, early Christian, might have been making a display. A display of a dead body and saying, this is Jesus, and perhaps it was a clay model of Jesus, and perhaps it had thorns, and perhaps it left a trace onto the shroud, and perhaps the shroud was preserved as the genuine shroud of Jesus, when in fact, it's a post-imitation of the scene that's described in the Bible. So given this possibility, you have to kind of exclude all of those correlations between the injuries and the narrative in the Bible. Because the narrative in the Bible may have been copied by someone who wanted to recreate the actual event. And so if someone was to make this display of a clay model of Jesus being wrapped in a shroud, if that person was hosting a church, maybe he was a priest, maybe he was an early priest, something like that, that person may one day die, and that shroud may get wrapped, and his clay models may get destroyed, but some nun might have kept the shroud and might have started saying, this is the shroud of Jesus. or might have been misheard in the process of the telephone game of human culture and might have been transmitting the false idea somehow, maybe accidentally, that it was the actual shroud wrapping the actual body of Jesus, when in fact it was wrapping a clay model with a fake thorn on it. Because of this possibility, I am unconvinced that the Shroud of Turin is the real shroud that wrapped the historical Jesus. But I find the question fascinating, and I wouldn't dismiss it as impossible. I would simply say, I'm 50-50. I would need more facts to be convinced that it even is the most plausible hypothesis that it's a real shroud. I still remain undecided, agnostic. That is my state. All of this, I spent 20 minutes answering a $1 super chat. But that is the state. All right, we have a spammer here. We have spammers on the chat. Epic Games says, to what extent is nature right? Is it wrong to think that after thousands of years of natural selection, what was going on 10,000 years ago would be more desirable than our current influence reality? Is it wrong to think that after thousands of years of natural selection, what was going on 10,000 years ago would be more desirable than our current influence reality? Well, I don't think that nature gives you an answer that anything is right or wrong. So nature is just advancing, and it's the way it is, and things happen. So nature doesn't give you the point of reference of good or right or wrong. However, I am convinced that modernity is way too different, way too much of a shock to be claimed to have been the product of a legitimate, sustainable evolutionary drive. Now, I believe it's the product of evolution. Everything that a life form does is the product of evolution. But I believe it's a different claim to ask, is it durable? Or are we in a wave that has to have a backlash to it? And I believe we are in an enormous wave that is due for a backlash. That is, almost all of modern culture is unsustainable in the West. Almost all of it leads down the line to anti-natalism. So I believe it's absolutely unsustainable. But that's the way you should look at it. It's not so much it's right or wrong. It's just that whatever was going on 10,000 years ago was probably much less shocking to the genes than this world. This world is as shocking as it gets. Because there was none of our ancestors were ever presented the birth pill. None of our ancestors had the choice of abortion. None of our ancestors had actual cultural signals telling them maybe you shouldn't have babies. So we are definitely, I believe, at a peak disruption of unsustainable signals. That's how you should see it. Catherine Nadeau says, JF, do you think French language define the Quebecois culture, and is it disrespectful to not speak French in Quebec? Should we fight as much to preserve it? Definitely, French culture is demanded in Quebec. So there is an expectation in Quebec of people have to speak French. Now, this expectation is slightly loosened in Montreal and eventually fully loosened, I believe. Now, in Montreal, they will still welcome you at Tim Hortons drive-thru, and they will say something like, bonjour, hi. This is what... I don't think that Americans can understand this. Can you imagine an oppressive government to the extent that every single restaurant person at the drive-thru must and does welcome you by saying bonjour, hi? That is saying hi in two different languages. That is a fascinating thing, because it's a mix of the demand, which is, well, these people are disconnected from Quebec culture in Montreal. Lots of migrants, lots of Anglophones. And so they expect the English. But at the same time, they are imposed French by the government, and they cannot give prior presentation to... They cannot give prior presentation to English, which is also why, even in Alberta, if I buy a can, there are exactly two languages with the exact same height of representation. Now, understand, this is not something that Albertans have demanded. It's simply that for your can to be Quebec compatible, you end up producing all of your Canadian cans, if you're a corporation, in the same process, and so you end up putting French everywhere. So that is the state of language in Quebec. Now, you ask, should we demand cultural adherence? I used to be a nationalist and to believe strongly in protection of French status in Quebec. But I think that when you have to impose it by force and law, it's a sign that there's something wrong with your society to begin with. Ideally, I would want French culture to survive, but I think that the obsession of the Québécois around the culture rather than the genes is misplaced. And so I believe that the Québécois are not paying attention to the right thing. They're paying attention to language. But what does that lead them to do? It led them to accept Muslim immigration, Indian immigration, as long as you can speak Quebecois. And this leads to very bad decisions. And also Haitian immigration, African immigration. All of this because these people happen to know a little bit of French. They get specially selected and they get into Quebec society. Now, I believe that there is a problem with this in the sense that Quebec is deluding itself that it's maintaining its culture, but your culture doesn't matter. If you get rug-pulled genetically, your culture doesn't matter. The culture is not what's to be preserved. What's to be preserved is the continuity of your people, and that's genes. So I am on the fence on this obsession, this Quebecois obsession with the protection of French. I think that it's not misleading, it's not bad in and of itself, but it also illustrates a deep weakness of the Quebecois handling of the question of their own survival. LDR has sent a super chat, thank you very much. Bird Flu has sent another super chat. $10 pour vous, monsieur. Well, thank you very much. Very appreciated. Let's have a look at... We had a couple of super chats coming in. Thank you. Thank you for covering for the poor. Since I gave a quality answer, I believe that it's like... there's not many public speakers who remember exactly a Tucker Carlson video that they watched 6 months ago, and they remember their entire mental process. Yes, it does deserve more than $1. I mean, can you imagine? I stop you on the street. You're like, you're jogging. You're not thinking about anything particular. I'm like, what's your opinion on the Shroud of Turin? Can you imagine having to go 20 minutes justifying the entirety of your epistemological belief and being able to remember all of the details? I think I deserve that $43. Thank you very much, Nate Dogg Revolution, for covering for the poorer audience. Jackie Chan.
Some scientists think lower allergy rates of children raised in Amish villages are that way due to inhaling cow endotoxins, i.e. being around cows a lot. Modernity has its issues.
I'm not aware of this particular hypothesis, that the Amish would have low amounts of allergies specifically because being around cows. It's possible. I tend to think that it stems from much more the whole rejection of society. When you think about everything that's different from Amish life to life in the city, fluoride, vaccines, over-medicalization, over-socialization, there is a stack of things. And I'd be very surprised if down the line it boils down to just being around cows. Yeah, it's like, I know that it's very fashionable to believe in gut bio, microbiome, and how ultimately being around dirt protects you because it trains your immune system or whatever. And I think it might very well be a part of the explanation. But I believe there are probably much more, there's a much broader set of things that the Amish do that probably contributes to wellness. And I think it's, well, they are away from pollution. They are away from vaccines. They are away from over-medicalization. They have a trust in nature. They have much liberty. Maybe not liberty in the capitalist sense exactly, but family liberty, you know, being relatively loosely brought up in an environment where they're not over-constrained by schedule and modern annoyance, fluoride, service water from the taps, bottles, microplastics. When you stack all of this, you're like, is it really just the cows or is it more like all of this? I think it's probably all of this. Jackie Chan says, fair enough. It was just one thing I saw that made me think that. Yeah, absolutely. I think the cows might very well contribute. I'm sure there's lots of positives of being close. First, being close to your meat that you're going to eat. Just the fact that you're around the meat that you're going to eat and versus processed in a manufacturer and wrapped and sent to you and transported, just this can contribute. Catherine Nadeau says, because it's normal to like to live with other people who had the same history as you, we can relate regardless of their race. Yes, I don't know what it's referring to, but yes. Epic Games says, I've recently learned that a lot of human anatomy, stomach, acid, pH, intestinal tract length, is conducive to eating raw and even rotting meat. If this is our natural diet, would it be optimal? Well, I don't necessarily recommend because you don't know. Even if your ancestors ate something rotted and didn't die from it, you don't know with the modern things. Like, it's very possible that if you were to do this with manufactured products, that they represent a risk that your ancestors haven't. been able to handle. So I wouldn't recommend going for rotten stuff. Though I believe that there is a modern obsession with cleanliness of food that is misplaced indeed. One of the things, in fact, I talk about in White People Food is that you should absolutely leave your meat on the counter to dry for hours. And in fact, you could leave it exposed and unwrapped in the fridge for days, with the idea of drying it, of having it lose some water, because the water eventually disrupts the cooking. And there's nothing better than dried meat. I'm not thinking about jerky dried here. I'm talking about just lose some water weight in your meat. Don't hesitate. It makes the muscle more fibrous. It's easier to cook. There's less heat absorption by the water, so the heat gets more straight to your meat. And it creates this perfect cooking, really. There's no way to properly cook a steak that is too wet. Keep that in mind. There is a form of equilibrium that shows in a... You have to put less heat. Once you have rid the meat of water, it will require less heat to get to a browning that is satisfying. But that browning will come exactly at the right balance. And it's a browning that is unaccomplishable onto a wet piece of meat. So yes, this modern idea that everything must be kept in the fridge forever until the last second, that actually leads to improper processing, culinary processing of steaks. And yes, our stomachs are supposedly able to handle a couple of bacteria. It's not supposed to be the case that you eat sterile food. That has never been the case in the history of humanity. And there's this whole concept of telling pregnant women, don't eat sushi, don't eat bologna, don't eat ham, everything must be cooked. These nurses are saying this to women, but I don't know of any evidence that telling them this and them doing it actually saves any infection cases. Like, how many infection cases are in the U.S. that will end up killing a pregnant woman? Somewhere close to zero, probably. So why are we giving these extreme advice that are actually disrupting people away from their normal patterns of eating? It's really unhelpful. Plapida says, Jeff, food ID for your book, Biltong, South African method of curing beef, somewhat like jerky. I have it noted already. I've seen it in pictures. I haven't decided yet if I'm integrating it to the book, but I certainly will have one or two South African elements. There's already the bobo something, and then the round sausage, because I really want to cover all white culture across the world. Jackie Chan says, Jeff, I was trained to always cook ground beef extra done to kill bacteria. Do you agree? No. I think it's absolutely delicious to eat rare ground beef. Now, if you go at a restaurant in the U.S., they will even offer you rare burgers. Very often, they will have to... I think they have to ground it freshly, so it's not like... there are certain forms of ground beef that don't preserve well, and you don't want to cook them rare. But if you have very fresh meat, and it's of quality, and perhaps you grounded it yourself even, it's absolutely fine to eat raw meat. I love tartar. I love tartar. And I loved when I was going to the Federal in North Carolina to order a very rare burger. That's always what I was asking. Very rare, with an extra blue cheese slice on it. And sometimes with a Caesar salad with deep fried oysters. That was my favorite food at the Federal. Plapides says, if you grind the meat yourself, then it's probably okay. But if it's ground by someone else, you don't know what got in there. Yes, absolutely. Manas says, Jeff, I think you would really find the dietic theory of Gottes syringe quite interesting. You seem to have naturally come close to his ideas as a result of your own intellect. Okay, well, again, you talk to me about Gottes syringe every time I stream. I still don't know what that is. Like, if I Google Gottes syringe diet, will that return a result, or is that just a guy? That's what I don't understand. See, I ask AI, I ask Google, and it says the goat syringe diet is not a recognized or standard diet. If you meant something else or need information on a specific diet, please clarify. Okay, so it's a YouTuber. The thing is, I'm never going to follow a YouTuber or listen to videos about dieting. Never. Syringe. Gottes syringe. Okay, so there you go. The bacteria and parasite deception, raw food and fear mongering. Okay. Okay. 10 years without a job. Syringe. I'm never going to watch these videos because I don't give a shit about dieting. I don't care. And I'm never going to care about... I care about culinary art. I don't care about dieting. I don't care about health recommendations. I am a culinary art maxer. All I care about is the pleasure of absolute special food for the hedonistic aspect of it at the cost of health if needed. Because in my view, you only have one life and you can pack pleasure into it in the forms of trying all sorts of culinary stuff. Now, you can try to preserve that life a little longer by eating healthy. You might also die of other things. So it's not like the edge that you gain from being obsessed about health is giving you maybe 5 to 10 years of survival. More than someone like me who doesn't care about it. Now, 5 and 10 years of survival is not something to spit on, but it's also not worth, in my view, depriving yourself of pleasure on this earth. Someone says, JF, how do you use MATLAB and Simulink these days? Well, I don't do much MATLAB these days. MATLAB is good. I do mostly Python right now because Python seems to be the language in which Grok more naturally produces stuff. So I've switched to Python. Python is absolutely great. I'm not a long-term Python programmer, but in order to interact with Grok, Grok has naturally come back to me very often with Python script, and so that's where I started from. That's what I start with. So now MATLAB is a very decent platform. It's just it's a platform that I believe is still commercial that you have to pay for. So you kind of have to have maybe an academic access or some other access to it because the price is exorbitant. And down the line, Python will allow you to do just as much, if not more, for free. Does Grok work well with NumPy for simulation? Absolutely. Grok can program in any language, and I don't know that I've done simulation with Grok, but certainly he's been providing stuff with the NumPy and plot, pyplot, MATLAB lib or MATLIB. So definitely, yes, if you want to do biology and gene engineering, you say, well, careful with that. Careful with that. But yes, Grok could allow you to experiment. I don't see any limits to it because Grok has been providing answers to anything really that I've asked. And he will just deliver the script outright. Just tell him, hey, I want a script that tests these theoretical genes in a simulated reality. I want the frame rate of that simulated reality to be this, and I want these events to happen. He's just going to deliver you in 5 minutes. You're going to get everything you need. That's it for today, boys. Much love, and I will see you all tomorrow.